Hello and welcome to Wellness with Liz Earle. And today I am truly delighted to have sitting beside me a world-class medic, a breast cancer surgeon who has been top of his tree for more years than many of us have even been alive. Professor Michael Baum qualified as a doctor in 1960, a very clever and skilled surgeon. He went on to hold chairs of surgery at King's College and University College London, as well as later working as a professor of surgery at the world-renowned Royal Marsden Hospital and the Institute of Cancer Research. He studied his specialist subject, breast cancer, for the last 50 years, and there surely can be few in the world who know as much on this as he. Professor Baum, welcome.
Thank you for that lovely introduction. I wish my mother was being alive to hear that.
Well, you know, I have to say, it is a rare privilege to have the chance to chat to such a world-renowned expert. And so we are going to make the most of this opportunity. We're going to be a bit greedy, actually, listeners, because we are recording two podcasts. So the first is going to be looking at breast cancer, as it's such a vast and complex topic, what it is, how it develops, how to treat it. And then the second podcast is going to focus on other breast health issues such as breast pain, cysts and the like, as well as breast cancer screening, ways to improve healthcare and the quality of life for midlife women overall. And that will include the role of HRT also. So you're going to have to listen to both episodes. So let's dive in at the beginning. Why breast cancer? Was that always something that interests you particularly?
That's a good question. After I got my fellowship, FRCS, then I was ambitious to follow a career in academic surgery. And so you had to choose a research subject. And at that time, I recognised, probably this was the most important thing that I did, I recognised that no one knew anything about breast cancer. Everyone claimed they knew. There was one answer, radical mastectomy. Catch it early, radical mastectomy, full stop.
Right.
And my research was on the natural history of breast cancer, what happens to breast cancer if you don't treat it. And I realised no one knows anything about this subject. They claim they know a lot about this subject, but no one knows anything. And what a wonderful virgin field to plough.
Yeah.
So that's how I started, got really into it. But then, sadly, after a few years, my mother was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, secondary breast cancer in the skeleton, and she had a terrible death in agony from bone metastases.
Oh,
and the treatments she had were as bad as the disease. The chemotherapy she had was made her lose her hair. She had beautiful long black hair, which she prided herself on. She lost her hair. And then my reaction to that was one of anger. I was really, really angry.
Yeah.
But I didn't know who to be angry with. And that kind of motivated me to take this on more than just an intellectual exercise, but to realise that women who you love are suffering very, very badly.
Mm.
So it's an issue of going beyond wanting to get a PhD and MD and become a professor. And actually, I had a fire in my belly.
This extraordinary personal fire within you.
Mm.
You must have realised very early on just how extraordinarily complex
Yes.
breast cancer is, because you've got the basic anatomy of the breast, you've got the endocrine systems, the hormones, you've got all the other things at play there.
Yes.
Was there one particular area that you thought, I'm going to focus on this particular section?
Let me give you a broader answer to that and then narrow down.
Mm-hmm.
And I often like to explain it this way. I used to be external examiner in Belfast for the final degree in surgery. And as you go into Belfast, there was graffiti on a wall. Every time I saw the same graffiti, and it said, anyone who can explain the Irish situation doesn't understand it.
So complicated.
I suddenly realised that sums up breast cancer. Everyone can explain it, but no one understands it. So, yes, the issue is it's an incredibly complex disease. And if you don't accept the complexity of it. And if you're looking for simple solutions for complex problems, you're wasting your time. Mm. So I think right from the beginning, I realized we're dealing with complexity. Mm-hmm. And if you're dealing with complexity, then you go back, try and go back to the beginning. Say, okay, let's forget about treatment and diagnosis. See if I can write a thesis on the natural history of breast cancer. Mm. What happens if you don't treat breast cancer? And I did a lot of research and I published and got my thesis through. And the conclusion was, we don't know the natural history of breast cancer.
That is really fascinating. Well, we will come on and we'll talk about treatment and non-treatment and the pros and cons of both. But let's just take a step back even further. You talk about the natural history of it. Is breast cancer something that's been around since the beginning of time? Are there examples of that?
Yes, breast cancer goes back as far as written records exist. And the earliest written record of it is an Egyptian papyrus, which was probably 1500 before the Common Era, something like that. Mm. So there's the Egyptian papyrus, the medical papyrus, which describes, I can almost remember the translation, he, and it was always a he, there wasn't a she in ancient Egyptian
text. Didn't exist.
he that gets a swollen tumour of the breast, and it is cold, do not cut. And he that gets a tumour on the breast that is hot, then you cut. Because if you cut a cold tumour, it gets worse, and if you cut a hot tumour, it gets better. And that was a demarcation, very, very clear demarcation between an abscess, which is a hot lump,
right,
and draining the pus and it's cured, and a cancer, which is a cold lump.
Isn't that extraordinary that they knew that then?
I mean, we're talking 3,500 years ago.
That's extraordinary.
And then, of course, the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Greeks knew a lot about it. And Hippocrates described cancer the crab. So the fact we call it cancer is thanks to Hippocrates. That's going back to 500 BCE.
So cancer comes from the zodiac sign, then, does it, from the stars?
Well, cancer is the crab.
Yes.
So the ancient Greek physicians described cancer as like a crab because it had tentacles, claws going out in all directions. Mm. So it's cancer the crab, which is also the zodiac sign.
Isn't that interesting? I didn't know that. And I know that because you are an extraordinary artist now. You've retrained, you know, later in life as an artist. And you've seen signs of breast cancer in paintings, haven't you?
Yes, I've made a study of, in fact, in a couple of weeks' time, I've been asked to speak at Europa Donna. That's the European Movement for Breast Cancer annual meeting. And the title of my talk is The History and Mystery of Breast Cancer Seen Through the Eyes of a Surgeon, of an Artist.
The history and mystery
of breast cancer as seen through the eyes of the artist. And I can trace the whole story of breast cancer by using fine art. It's always been there.
So there's lovely sort of Botticelli images of women reclining on chaise longue or whatever. I mean, are there examples of them with breast cancer?
Botticelli didn't paint a breast cancer. Rembrandt did.
Did he really?
Yes, without knowing it. And that's the most famous depiction of breast cancer in fine art.
So how is that depicted then?
It's the paintings in the Louvre, and it's Bachevaux at a toilet, and it was painted in 1664, and the model that was his model mistress housekeeper, Hendrika Stoffels, and in the upper outer quadrant of the left breast there, you can see a definite dimple,
really?
Which is absolute classic sign of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And then you read about her. Very well documented, and she died 8 years later. Now, and the way she died was of someone with bone metastases and jaundice. It's all very well described. And
so he thought he was painting just a dimple breast and didn't
just
realize
a dimple
that
breast. He was painting the early sign of the death of his beloved model.
That is just extraordinary. Now, a lot of this is obviously about women. Are men affected? I mean, do we need to pay tribute to guys with breast cancer too? Do you see many of those?
Breast cancer in men happens, and it's rare. The textbooks say 1 in 100. Well, I think that's an overestimate because I've been doing this game for nearly 50 years and I think I've seen 3 men with breast cancer.
Right.
Yes, they get it, and but the only difference is they get it 10 years later on average.
Right.
But otherwise, it's much the same.
And is it on the increase for women? Because we hear so much in the media about it now. Statistically, is it increasing?
It's an artifact, yes. It's gone up by 30% ever since they started screening.
Right.
And it's an artifact of screening, the increase.
So we're just picking up more cases.
Yes.
There aren't actually any more physical cases than we would know otherwise.
We're going to talk about screening a bit later on.
Mm.
But one of the downsides of screening is overdiagnosis.
Right.
And the apparent increase in incidence is... it's just because of overdiagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a bias. It's called ascertainment bias.
Okay, great. Well, we will definitely come back to that because there is a whole discussion around screening. When it comes to developing breast cancer, what are the risks, though? What are our main risks as women?
The main risk is age.
Is it? So don't get old, basically.
Well, I think the alternative is worse.
Exactly. So when you say age, at what point does it statistically start to hit us significantly?
Every time you see proponents promoting screening, it's always a nubile young woman in the mammography machine,
mm-hmm.
which is misleading.
Mm-hmm.
Breast cancer under the age of 30 is very, very rare.
Right.
The highest incidence of breast cancer is in the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But the incidence goes up and up with age.
Right.
But, of course, women are dying of other things at mm-hmm. the same time.
Yes.
So the prevalence gets less,
mm-hmm.
but the incidence gets more. So the older you are, the greater the risk getting it.
And dietary factors?
Well, in order of importance, mm-hmm. Bad family histories.
Okay.
So age, family history, and beyond that, all the other risk factors are quite small. Someone says this is associated with a 20% increase relative risk, that is actually a very small increase. It sounds frightening, but these are very small, like alcohol, and they say 20% relative increase. But you then got to translate that into absolute numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a key thing to understand these statistics.
Yes.
The difference between relative and absolute risk. And I'll do a very simple sum. For a woman over the age of 50, the incidence per year is 2 per thousand. All right?
Mm-hmm.
2 per thousand. So over
Which
10 years.
Which is very small.
Yes. It's much less
thankfully.
Than people think.
Yes.
So that's 2 per 100 over 10 years.
Right.
All right. So a 20% increase is 20% of 2. Over 10 years.
Right, so that's
a small number, and it's so small that we should ignore it.
Yeah, yeah.
Not frightening women off having drinking.
Well, this is the thing, and I'm really pleased that you've raised this actually as a topic overall, because you see so many frightening headlines where, you know, you say, I don't know, eating peanut butter doubles your risk of breast cancer or whatever. And I just pulled that out of the air. Obviously, it doesn't for anybody eating peanut butter. But it may be that peanut butter, say, cause 1 in 1 million breast cancers, say, and then the studies come out to say, oh, no, it's not 1 in 1 million, it's 2 in 1 million. But that's still double the risk, isn't it?
But of course, the risk is tiny.
Two times
the risk. And the other thing is, it's an associated
risk.
It's not necessarily causal, because the type of women who eat a lot of peanut butter may have other problems.
Right. Yeah, so you're not saying it's causing it.
No, it's the intake of peanut butter suggests to me that this woman needs healthcare in other ways, like the head.
Yes. Now that I understand, and I didn't fully understand before, but it is such a simple thing to understand the headlines when something says double double the risk or three times the risk. Yeah. It's kind of irrelevant because you say, well, what was the risk to start with?
Yes.
And that's what they don't tell you.
So these are relative risk versus absolute numbers. Mm-hmm. And it's critical. I get so angry.
Yes.
Every month there's another headline.
Well, tell me about it. I mean, we are battling the media, having written about
and it's always
all
bad
of this.
News.
Isn't it? Well, good news doesn't sell a newspaper.
No, so I'm told, yes.
Doesn't sell, you know, online advertising on a website. Mm. So let's talk about the different types of breast cancer, because I have to say I'm very fortunate. I don't have history in my family. I do have girlfriends who are affected by it, actually right now at the moment, but I'm not very clear on the different types and what the different diagnoses mean for people.
I'm trying to keep this simple.
Thank you.
It gets very, very technical.
Yes.
The technicalities actually aren't important because there are two types of cancer to begin with. Duct carcinoma in situ meaning in place, which is not invasive cancer, and invasive cancer, that cancer which invades. Now, putting duct carcinoma in situ on one side, and I'll get to that when we come to talk about screening, we start with invasive cancer, and then you can look at it under the microscope, and we have many ways of prognosticating, and they are graded, grade 1, 2, 3. 3 is aggressive looking, 1 is slow growing. Mm-hmm. And there are all sorts of more and more biological, molecular studies where you can predict the prognosis. So, in fact, one could almost say every single breast cancer is unique.
Right.
Unique in itself and in the host, the patient, the woman being the host. So you've got almost an infinite number
of variables that you would have.
Of variables. Mm-hmm.
But presumably it's the invasive cancers that are the deadliest kind, are they?
The invasive cancer, the in situ cancers don't kill.
Do they not?
No. And the problem with the in situ cancers, they're overdiagnosed, overtreated.
Well, the minute you say somebody you've got cancer, I mean, forget it. You're going to panic mode, don't you?
Exactly. That is such an important issue that specialists now, like me, are trying to change the nomenclature.
Right. So you don't call it cancer. It's a non-invasive lump or something.
We're trying to agree on some formula of words that doesn't include cancer.
Interesting.
Because 10-year survival of removing duct carcinoma in situ is 99%. Why is it a cancer then? It isn't a cancer.
Right, so it's not one of these spreading, and that's when you get sort of secondary cancers, is that right? So does breast cancer often start as a primary and then spread?
It always starts. Well, it always starts as a primary. Yes, it's a primary. And then it can metastasize, spread anywhere in the body.
And is it because it's close to the lymph nodes that it makes it faster to spread?
No. That's again the old-fashioned idea. The great revolution in the treatment of breast cancer was probably in the 1970s when we realized that breast cancer wasn't spreading along the lymph. It spreads along lymphatics, but that isn't what metastasizes. It's spreading in the blood vessels. So it's invasion of the venous drainage of a breast cancer that leads to metastases.
Right.
And that can happen at any stage. Mm. And we think, the latest thinking of this, it happens in most cases very early on, and the cancer cells that spread find a niche somewhere in the body and just sit there.
Right.
And what turns them on to progress is uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a very good friend, close friend, who was treated for breast cancer 25 years ago, and the secondaries have just appeared.
Gosh, after 25 years.
After 25, well, what's going on there?
Yeah,
you can't say they're growing slowly for 25 years.
Mm.
So if to even think in linear terms like this is obsolete.
Right.
You've got to get it out of your head. The natural history of breast cancer isn't linear progression.
Mm-hmm.
And a better analogy is weather forecasting.
Well, one day it's sunny, one day it's rainy, and you just don't know.
And we're getting very good at weather forecasting.
Right. Yes.
And that's because we use a non-linear model. We talk about linear models and non-linear models. And non-linear models are chaos theory.
Right.
Everybody thinks they know about chaos theory, but it's not linear. But we can use a new type of mathematics, chaos theory mathematics, as the weather forecasters do.
And you can use that in breast cancer.
Well, we should be doing it. I work with mathematicians and come up with some formulae that may help us. But you've got to have the will to pursue that.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much investment in the idea that there's a linear progression when it's not. It's chaotic. You know, if you see a small cloud in the sky, that doesn't mean it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and become a black cloud and there'll be a downpour.
No, it might get blown away by a gust of wind and disappear, and then the sky is then blue.
And the sky goes blue.
Mm.
So one trajectory for that small cloud is a thunderstorm, and the other is to go away. That's chaos theory,
right.
And that I think explains breast cancer.
Mm.
So, but we still haven't perfected the mathematics of this.
Now, you have been involved in so much pioneering research and practical work on breast cancer because I think when you first started, you alluded at the beginning to when it was radical mastectomy, the entire breast comes off, end of story. Were you one of the first to introduce the idea of lumpectomy and minimal invasive surgery?
Right. I don't want to claim too much for myself. The temptation is there because you're not old enough to know I'm kind of a historic figure, so I do know exactly what happened. Certainly when I qualified and when I was training as a surgeon, there were no questions. It was obvious. Radical mastectomy. It isn't just removing all the breasts, it's removing the muscles and all the lymph nodes. A really major operation. That was the answer. And if it came back, well, it's the patient's fault. She should have come earlier.
Right.
So you dismiss it. And I was taught to do that operation. I was able to do it without losing much blood. And it was a horrid thing.
I hated doing it.
And then I started reading the writings of Dr. Bernard Fisher in Pittsburgh, and he was the revolutionary, and he made stuff change. So I went to work with Bernie Fisher in Pittsburgh, and I, in 1970-71, he was coming up with the biological model that refuted the Halstedian approach. And he was the one that showed the cancer cells spread very early along the veins, and removing the breast was closing the stable door after the horse had bolted.
It's not going to make much difference then.
Yes. So he thought, in that case, the only way, there's no point in doing mutilating surgeries, so we could try breast-conserving surgery with followed by radiotherapy. And that could produce the local control, which is very important.
To take the lump away.
Yeah. And followed by radiotherapy.
Yeah.
And the only way to cure more patients was systemic therapy, drug therapy, to mop up the cancer cells that have escaped.
That have escaped, got you.
So I became his disciple, and he started they were just competing who was first, Veronese in Milan or Fisher in Pittsburgh. But almost synchronously, they started doing the trial, breast-conserving surgery versus radical mastectomy. I went back to London and set up our study, breast-conserving surgery versus mastectomy. And at the same time, the Milan group and the Pittsburgh group were testing out chemotherapy, adjuvant chemotherapy. I decided to use tamoxifen.
Right.
So the tamoxifen adjuvant, that's the drug treatment as well as surgery. We did the tamoxifen approach, and Veronese and Fisher did the chemotherapy approach.
And who came out top?
We all came out top.
Was it a tie? Was it working for everybody?
The adjuvant chemotherapy worked, adjuvant tamoxifen worked. Right. Combination works. And then okay. you get to the point of selecting, better ways of selecting patients. So
right.
It's all been fine-tuning. Yes.
Well, we're hearing that now, aren't they?
Yes.
That chemotherapy will only work for certain people.
And yes.
It's how do you then do genetic screening to say, is that going to work
yes.
for you?
Yes, so we're starting to refine it, select our patients better yep. for these different
So why genes. Did you choose tamoxifen? Because that was quite a new drug, wasn't it,
right
then?
Two reasons. A, to do something different.
Right, be radical.
B, because I think it was kinder.
Right.
And this brings me back to my mother, who suffered terribly from chemotherapy.
Yeah.
So before doing the trial, the adjuvant trial, when I was in Cardiff, we did a trial with advanced breast cancer comparing chemotherapy with tamoxifen and saw there wasn't much difference. But the quality of life was better on tamoxifen. Yeah.
How do they work? I know that chemotherapy is destroying your immune system.
Well, that's
essentially,
not.
It's is not meant.
No, it's chemotherapy. The simplest way of looking at chemotherapy, the more rapidly the cell grows and reproduces, the more likely it responds to chemotherapy. So there's quite a narrow margin, and if you've got rapidly growing cancers, rapidly dividing cells, chemotherapy is more effective than slowly dividing
cells.
So that's just catching the cell when it's vulnerable at the point of
But you have to blast the whole body,
you have to blast all the cells. Yes, it's all over, and tamoxifen, now we're not sure how it works.
Really?
But originally we thought, it's an anti-estrogen. So that's why it works, because it's an anti-estrogen. And of course now it's not. We know it's not an anti-estrogen, and we're not sure how it works.
That's fascinating. So who first was looking at it? Because it comes from Taxol, doesn't it?
Tamoxifen has nothing to do with Taxol. No, it was developed at ICI in the late 1960s, and they were trying to produce a contraceptive. So they were testing this, quote, contraceptive on mice with cancer.
Right.
And to their amazement, found it wasn't a very good contraceptive. It was actually a fertility drug.
Oh, really?
So how it then came into the treatment of breast cancer, it's difficult to know.
Does it have any connection with you then? Is it anything to do with Taxol?
Nothing to do with Taxol. It's a synthesized.
Right.
It's a complex molecule which has been synthesized. It's not a natural problem.
And what happens, where does Taxol come into it then?
Nowhere.
It doesn't. Okay, fine.
Taxol is another cytotoxic drug which happens to come from the uterine, which is seldom used in breast cancer.
Is it not used in breast cancer?
No, seldom.
Okay.
Yeah.
So going back to the estrogen point of tamoxifen, originally, it was given as being anti-estrogenic.
Yes.
That was the theory.
Yes.
With the theory being that breast cancer grows in estrogen. Is that right?
That's
in an estrogen-rich environment.
Yes, that's right. And that's a very simple solution to a complex problem.
Okay. So, in other words, that's not the case.
No, and we know it's not the case because one of the side effects of tamoxifen is endometrial cancer. And you have to look out for it. It's rare, but it's a side effect. Now, why? Well, it's because it's estrogenic.
Right.
So tamoxifen.
So it's producing estrogen.
It is in itself estrogenic. The endometrium recognises tamoxifen as an estrogen. So calling tamoxifen an anti-estrogen is wrong.
This is all very, very fascinating. And I know that you've written a little bit as an endorsement of Professor Blooming's book,
yes.
Estrogen Matters, and
yes.
that was a really revelatory read, and I think that's recently published in this country. And
yes, and perhaps we'll come back to that.
Absolutely,
when
definitely,
about HRT,
we will. Yeah, definitely.
But it is not easy.
No, you can really see that.
To say estrogen causes breast cancer, therefore getting rid of the estrogen will cure breast cancer, it's simply wrong.
It's simply
People
wrong.
Want simple answers. There's no simple
there is,
answers.
Oh my goodness, I can really see this. And then, so what about radiotherapy? Where does that all fit in with cancer treatment, breast cancer treatment?
Radiotherapy It's a very effective treatment if used correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very privileged in this country. We have brilliant, excellent radiotherapists and equipment. And the convention is, after removing the lump,
yes,
then you irradiate the whole breast, because we know from pathological study of the whole breast that even though you've got one cancer there, there are other foci all over the breast, little foci. And so you have to blast those with radiotherapy in case they progress. Yeah. Except that's not true.
What? Okay, so how does it really work then?
Well, I've been working for 20 years with a young, well, he's not so young now, but he was a very young Indian PhD student of mine, Jayant Vaidya, who's now Professor Vaidya at UCL. And he pointed out that local recurrence after treating breast cancer is always at the index quadrant, where the original cancer was, and not in all these other places.
I.e., so where you first pick it up is where it's going to reoccur.
Where it recurs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a lovely story and a long story, but just to make it very, very short, we developed a technique for giving radiotherapy at the time of surgery just to the tumour bed and nowhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a trial. We started it 20 years ago. 3,500 women in this study. Half had conventional external beam radiotherapy and the other half had intraoperative radiotherapy.
Mm.
One shot at the time of surgery.
In surgery,
and
gosh.
The outcomes are identical. So we're trying very hard to promote this technique.
Yes.
And it's available pretty much all over the world now, except for this country.
Good heavens.
Because the Royal College of Radiologists hate it.
Why? Because everyone's going to be unemployed and not have enough patients to treat?
No.
Or?
Because a couple of surgeons invented the technique.
Right, oh dear.
In fairness,
yes.
Professor Tobias was also part of the unholy trinity, and so he was also, he had a radiotherapy.
Yeah, this is really fascinating, and, not going into specifics there, but what I've learned through having, the enormous privilege of speaking and meeting so many medics in so many fields of medicine is the extraordinary rivalry and politics that go on, and the bias of people who publish a paper and then it's not peer reviewed, or if the study doesn't work out in the way that they wanted, it gets buried and it gets submitted to the BMJ or the Lancet, and then the editor decides whether to print it or not to print it. I mean, it's not a level playing field, is it, when it comes to research and
well,
review.
The best analogy I can for the what goes on in the scientific community, it's a bit like Brexit and the
Parliament. Oh, don't!
The jealousies and the infighting has to be seen to be believed.
But you kind of hope and would assume that everybody's working to the common good.
Of
but
course, just like we hope every politician is working for
enough.
Their constituency.
But I think the good news in all of this is that advances in treatment of whatever kind, we have seen a 50% reduction in deaths from breast cancer overall.
Joking aside, what happens in this is we're talking about scientific discourse. If one professor says it is us and the other professor says no, it's not, then that is a dialectic and it's a healthy, because out of this uncertainty, out of these debates, we make progress.
Mm-hmm.
And we make progress by falsifying ideas rather than constantly repeating our errors.
Right.
So good comes out of this dialectic and these fights. Good comes out of it. And yes, mortality from breast cancer peaked in 1985 in this country, and the mortality has fallen by 50% since 1985.
Mm. And what do you attribute that to mostly?
Treatment.
Using the mixture of chemo,
whatever.
Radiotherapy, tamoxifen.
Yeah. Treatment.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with screening.
Right. Well, we will definitely be talking about that. And I guess with the review of treatment, we can make better choices now based on mistakes in the past.
Yes. We talk a lot about clinical trials, randomised controlled trials. But these aren't guinea pigs, experimental animals. These are women.
Yes.
So why should women volunteer to go into an experiment?
Mm.
And the only way I can argue that is to say, well, other women did that in the past. You have the benefit of the progress that was made in the past by other women.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is an ethical imperative when invited for patients to join clinical trials.
Yes.
When offered.
Yes.
The care of women in clinical trials happens to be better as a general rule. So mm-hmm. it's in their enlightened self-interest.
Mm.
But it is an ethical dilemma.
Yes.
I'm not denying that. But yeah. as a result of these clinical trials, stepwise, we've made remarkable progress.
What about the advent of things like immunotherapy?
That's exciting. I'm not fully sure where it's going.
Mm.
It is exciting, but I think it's been hyped at the
right.
moment.
Yeah.
And I would urge caution,
mm.
that's all.
Mm.
I don't want to be negative, but I just urge caution.
Mm. Talking of hype, I'd be very interested to get your take on some of the myths that have kind of just become mainstream in the media. I obviously have a big background in beauty and the skincare industry. And it's hard to pick up a product that says it contains parabens, for example.
Mm.
And there was a huge furore linked to one study, which, as I understand, has never been replicated by a PhD researcher in Reading, which was shown to be just so poorly interpreted. And yet it led to the whole of the beauty industry taking out parabens from products, particularly underarm deodorants and breast cancer.
Oh,
you must have been working during all of that time.
God,
what's your take on that?
That was this week's scare story. Every week there's another scare story. Something is associated.
But it's taken a huge hold. People will still say, I'm not using deodorant or I'm not using
underwired
parabens.
Bras.
Right?
Do you remember underwired bras?
Yeah, causing breast cancer.
Causing breast cancer.
What's the truth?
Dyeing hair dyes.
Yes.
That was recent. And it drives me potty. Now, the reason why this is so common. We're talking about an association, not a cause.
Right.
And we're talking about relative risk. So pretty much everything you look at, if you don't have an a priori hypothesis, you say, we're just going to do it. There's no particular reason why parabens should cause breast cancer, but let's do it.
Mm.
And you do it. And yes, like peanut butter, suggested. Cause cancer.
Yeah.
I'm sure that if there is an association one way or another between peanut butter and breast cancer, it's either protective or harmful.
Yes, if you asked 5,000 women, do you eat peanut butter?
And, yes.
And then
analysed
who had breast cancer.
But there's no a priori hypothesis why peanut butter should cause or prevent breast cancer.
Well, of course,
cancer.
With parabens, the issue was that it was allegedly an endocrine disruptor that was applied near to the site of the breast tumour. But of course, as it was later found out, the parabens actually came from the glassware used in the laboratory, not in the tumours.
But the principle is still the same.
Yes, absolutely.
Pretty much anything that you look at with large enough numbers, they may be an association one way or the other. It will never be completely neutral.
No.
To make it absolutely neutral statistically is impossible.
Yeah.
So you can guarantee it will either be protective or associated with breast cancer, whatever.
Mm.
Anything, I guarantee that. Now, if it turns out to be protective, it won't get into the news.
No, because that's a good news story,
good news.
So we'll never hear about that.
So your experience with paraben is exactly the problem that we face all the time.
Yeah.
Drives you nuts.
Okay, in a nutshell, underwire bras, dangerous or not?
No.
Well,
it depends in which way.
Yes, I suppose so. Yes, it might ping off, poke you in the eye or something. But in terms of breast cancer?
No.
Yeah.
Deodorants, no.
Hair dye, no.
In-flight entertainment, no.
Wi-Fi devices, no. Anything else that's been linked. But what are the risks? Joking aside, we've talked about genetics.
Yes.
Is that really, you just a question, you've got to choose your parents very carefully?
Yes. At the moment, we have the BRCA mutations, BRCA1, BRCA2.
Right.
Very powerful genes. Mm-hmm. If you happen to inherit this gene, there's an 80% chance you're going to get breast cancer, and you're going to get it young, and it's going to be of the aggressive type.
So do you agree with the mastectomy in that case?
Reluctantly.
Reluctantly.
To me, it's intermediate technology. It's a step along the way. I don't think there's any evidence that screening will do anything. There's no evidence that screening will prevent death from breast cancer with a BRCA mutation, but there's good evidence that bilateral mastectomy will protect. And you know, Angelina Jolie, who
yes.
is lovely.
Yes.
We all, yes. all men love her.
Totally.
But she's brilliant. What a courageous woman. And she is kind of the poster girl for that. But we must do better than that.
Yes.
And there has to be, sooner or later, I'm sure we'll have the molecular correction for that abnormality. Mm. But for the time being, that's the best on offer.
So genetic screening really then still has to be the best way ahead for us?
At the moment, but only there are mostly the BRCA mutation, but there are other rarer mutations as well. Yeah.
Fascinating. Well, on that note, it is time to draw a close to this extraordinary podcast. I have learnt so much in a very short space of time. Sincere thanks, Professor Mike, for being with us today. It has, I'm sure you'll agree, been an especially informative and gripping episode, and one which we should share widely with our family and friends, especially anyone who has been or who is touched by this terrifying disease. So do please pass on the link on my website to connect others to this. Don't forget, you will find the notes and links to the resources we've been talking about here over on lizellewellbeing.com. You can also sign up there for our free weekly wellbeing newsletter packed with news, views, exclusive recipes and the like. This is something that we send out free of charge each and every Friday. And if you've enjoyed this episode, do hit the subscribe button on your podcast app to ensure that the next ones download automatically without you even having to remember. And you truly won't want to miss the next one as Professor Bam continues to be on my sofa here, continuing our journey into other aspects of breast care and midlife women's health in general, including specifically the role of HRT, which I know many of us will be especially interested to hear a lot more about. So until then, go well. Bye-bye. Thank you.